This patient told me a lot. The context was that I just finished my second training as a psychodynamic psychotherapist, and I felt I needed to prove a lot. And I clearly arrived with the wrong agenda. But it was that if I was a good enough and a smart enough, a clever enough, just graduated as a psychodynamic psychotherapist, I would manage to get into why the patient is struggling so much with the realization of the cancer of the mother, that is a resistant, he didn't want to touch the topic at all, and why is making him feel the way that it is, right? So basically, if I uncover the underlying reason why the cancer of his mother was so extremely distressing and be able to explore with him how he's processing this, I will be helping him. And I was extremely wrong. And I did a lot of interventions in between that the patient was really generous, really, really generous with me. And how the case, generous, what I meant is he was forgiven. He clearly was tolerating me trying to push for something he really had no appetite for. How meaningful psychoanalysis can be, but in a different way. Psychoanalysis is not only about clever interpretations. Psychoanalysis can be a lot about the tools to help us feel what we are experiencing. And in those radical settings, I have multiple examples of many times that you become almost the object you are projected, and you need a frame of mind to kind of ground you into you are not that and offer something different. So that is why I thought it was really useful.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast consists of conversations with psychoanalysts from around the world who share with us their clinical and psychoanalytic work with individuals both on and off the couch. And what we mean by off the couch is that they share with us their community involvement in many different venues apart from their consultation rooms. They describe their work in hospitals, in community clinics, in refugee centers, in classrooms, indeed in war zones. We also have conversations with psychoanalysts who are focusing their work on the couch, and they are continuing to refine both our familiar and novel understandings of the dynamic mind as it presents itself in the analytic situation. Please visit our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can subscribe, where you can see the recommended readings provided by our guests, and you can also leave a comment. I hope you enjoy these conversations and find them thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and our guest today is Rodrigo Sanchez Escandon. Rodrigo trained as a clinical psychologist in Mexico City, and he completed his psychoanalytic psychotherapy training at the Mexican Psychoanalytic Association before moving to London to undertake further psychoanalytic training at the British Psychoanalytic Association. Our conversation today is focused on his recent book entitled Contemporary Developments in Supportive Therapy, Principles and Practice. As you will hear, supportive psychotherapy isn't a common topic among psychoanalysts. And part of the reason is that the thinking about it, both theoretically and clinically, isn't, I think, well fleshed out in our field. And Rodrigo's book really addresses that. We talk about the differences between supportive and expressive psychotherapy. We talk about the types of patients who require one or the other form of intervention, with a specific focus on patients who are in crisis and patients whose entire lives is one of crisis. We talk about what indications there are to lead one to adopt a supportive or expressive approach. And we spend also time, Rodrigo, sharing with us the temptation to want to be an interpretive healer, to uncover the unconscious, that's a need, a desire that therapists have, either when they're students to do what they think their supervisors and program directors want them to do, or even later in life when they feel that that's what's valuable, that's what's important, that's what gives them self-esteem, all of which is in contrast to actually what the patient needs at any particular moment, the help in supporting their defenses as opposed to analyzing their defenses. He shares with us, nevertheless, how vital a psychoanalytic mindset can be in not necessarily interpretively, but of listening to where the patient is and knowing where to go and where not to go. He tells us a bit about his own personal journey and how helpful he has found a psychoanalytic mindset, even as he has worked extensively with homeless, with drug-addicted patients, with abused patients, and very much off the couch. I learned a great deal from Rodrigo, his book, his thinking, and I suspect many will as well. Here is my conversation with Rodrigo Sanchez Escandon. Rodrigo, welcome to the podcast. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you for having me.
We're here today to discuss supportive psychotherapy, and this isn't a topic that analysts usually speak to each other about, at least not in any formal sense. I suspect we sort of chat about it with our friends and colleagues, but you rarely see panels on it. And I think there are a number of reasons for that, one of which is that what we mean by supportive therapy and the technical approaches that are part of supportive therapy aren't very clear in our field and generally aren't taught, which is why your book is so important, because it does spell out through both clinical and theoretical presentations. It's also important for us to keep in mind that the line separating these two modalities are at times very clear, the difference between supportive and expressive interventions, and at times it's very ambiguous. And as you point out in the book, you remind us of the important research of Robert Wallerstein in the 1980s in his psychotherapy research project, where after careful investigation, he concluded that supportive elements are essential in all psychoanalyses and unfortunately are not generally recognized. So we will go through your book and illustrate these points, and then we will take up the sort of overarching question of, when we are sitting with a patient, what are the advantages and disadvantages of having in our mind a model of, well, this is supportive or this is expressive, or whether there's another way to engage with the patient, but we will get to that. Let me start us off by reading from the very beginning of the book, sort of an introductory paragraph, and then I'll ask you to elaborate on it. You write, "At its core, supportive therapy integrates elements of traditional psychoanalysis, such as understanding the patient's internal world and utilizing free association, with supportive techniques designed to foster emotional stability and engagement. However, it does not adhere to the traditional neutrality and abstinence that psychoanalytic interventions require. This approach is particularly effective for patients who lack the ego strength required for deeper interpretive work, or who find problem-focused therapies like CBT inadequate for their emotional needs. To determine whether a patient will benefit from supportive therapy, two factors need to be considered: the patient's capacity to relate to the therapist and their current source of distress." You want to start us off from there?
Yes, I think there are two points. One of them is the role of abstinent and neutrality that will be so active through all this process. And I think that one of the main elements is that when we're talking about psychoanalysis, Greenberg in 2001, he said, a good analyst is one that has a level of affiliation to a school with a level of flexibility, conveying how a good practitioner embodies a theoretical frame, a theoretical school, in a way that perhaps resonates to themselves, to their own experience, to their own identities. And then they bring that into the session with a level of flexibility, of course, of listening to other schools and other elements. But at the heart is that they bring a technique they feel they have worked for them, and then you have a patient and you see how you both interact, how we both match, and so on. In supportive therapy, you don't bring as much an analytic frame or analytic school or an abstinent, but a friendly attitude that is quite actively seeking engagement, that is quite actively avoiding the negative transference. So in that way, is from the beginning a different frame. I won't say that is really important. And yes, to determine if the patient is suitable, a lot of times the current distress is one that not the patient might not necessarily be too unwell for supportive therapy, but the stress they are going through in life will put them in a position where they will not be able to make use for anything that is not supportive. And I will take things even further and suggest that if the therapist, by trying to apply a particular exploratory technique, pushes, can be iatrogenic, can be stressing more a patient that cannot cope with that at the moment, and that for them might have been a massive effort to approach someone and ask for help, not knowing what to get, and suddenly just feel that at the end of one session, they are in a worse place.
So in a sense, you're saying, and I don't want to oversimplify this, but that the task, the challenge, the responsibility of the clinician is to meet the patient where they are. And that if a patient comes and they're in an acute stress, that one needs to be present for that and be, as you're calling it, be supportive. And tell me if I have this right. And you're leaving open the question of after the engagement around, the supportive engagement around this acute stressful situation resolves, that then the question could be asked, is it best to move on in a continuation of these supportive efforts, or might a more exploratory approach be indicated? Does that capture what you're saying?
Yes, because then it means that the patient might not cope very well with the change. I usually recommend to refer out. So, for example, two cases quite different. One in supportive therapy, the other one not in supportive therapy. The one in supportive therapy, we constantly engage talking about football. And I remember in one particular time, they knew the team that I cheer because I disclose it when they ask. And my team lost horrendously, like they usually do. And the patient arrived with a little bit of banter. And we were laughing a little bit with that banter, and it was kind of engaging in that way. Another patient in psychodynamic psychotherapy, she was a really hilarious woman that was going through something in her life, but the way she has always processed pain is through comedy. And she was skillful. And I remember that I never put her off for making jokes. I always smile a little bit, but I never laugh out loud, if you see what I mean. And I think we were in session 12 or 13, something like that, starting. But she caught me off guard and she managed to make me laugh. And she felt triumphant about it. And the reason why I didn't want to laugh is that I was in connecting with the fear that if therapy was not a joke, it was going to be really real and painful and serious. So I didn't want to turn therapy into a joke. But it was psychodynamic psychotherapy. And she was struggling, but she was able to bear that. The first patient was not able to bear absolutely any of this. So if suddenly the patient is in a better place, so to speak, how do you go about changing hats? How do you go about then suddenly pushing yourself back a little bit and not being so engaging? I personally don't think it's possible. I think that you kind of refer out to someone to do something different.
We're going to spend a moment on a clinical presentation demonstrating some of those very points, though I can't help but reflect on what you've presented about the patient who makes jokes and presumably is trying to make you laugh, and you, if I understand it right, resist the laughing until you were, quote, caught off guard. One could have a wonderful conversation about what it was like for each of you to resist the laughing and what it was like for each of you to not resist the laughing and how that could be unpacked maybe usefully for both. But let me start, before I ask you to introduce this supportive therapy patient, you give four principles of supportive therapy that are a good place for us to start. The first, number one, is called the setting and alliance. And you say, starting by establishing a strong and clear therapeutic contract. Number two, you write understanding and expression, creating a space where the patient feels understood and can express emotions freely. Ideally, the patient should experience the therapist and the therapeutic space in a unique personal way, unconstrained by rigid superego demands. Number three, avoiding repetition, using interventions not to uncover the unconscious, but to prevent actions that might lead to early termination due to the repetition of early relational patterns. And number four, a good ending, facilitating a mutually agreed upon ending. All these four are clear, though I do have a question that I'd like you to clarify. You say the therapist in the therapeutic space in a unique personal way, unconstrained by rigid superego demands. Superego demands, of course, are an internal construct of the patient. And if we only could address those superego demands or not, I mean, they are present as defined and created by the patient. Elaborate, if you will, what you mean by unconstrained by rigid superego demands.
I think a good example is something that happened in West London. There, I was working in partnership with a substance misuse agency. They were providing the therapy. I was looking after the patients. And something happened because out of the pressure, lack of resources or whatever, that they enacted the superego quite clearly. Because the problem with substance misuse is that it's really hard to kind of properly diagnose the level of subjectivity. People might drink a little bit and then feel that they have destroyed their lives, and people might be killing themselves in alcohol and not seek help. It's a bit of a tricky element. But patients sometimes take it black and white, no shapes of gray, and they will say, I drank one beer, I am worthless, I am pointless. You know, I lost my AA coin. Mm-hmm. I have completely relapsed. Who am I? They don't give themselves a break. And this clinic enacted, in my view, something really silly, because they turned around and they said, if you are drinking, you will not be able to continue with the process, because this is only for people that are taking it serious. Now, any substance misuse agency will need to have boundaries. If you don't have boundaries, everything goes down. So you might say you cannot come if you're intoxicated. There are different boundaries that need to be established. But to say to a patient, if you're struggling and you have a drink, you cannot come back, that is outrageous. That is preposterous. And this is a good representation of a superego within the room. That is suddenly not only the projections of the patients, but their own therapist kind of conveying a, this is how you should be. This is the path to cure. This is the path towards your well-being that suddenly has become another punitive superego demand on a patient that is not coping. So it's kind of reducing the expectations, reducing that level of potential things the patient can do wrong, and be truly welcoming at that level that the only thing the patient truly needs to do is engage, and that's it.
It's a good description. Let me ask you to introduce the patient that you speak of early in the book. This is a 40-year-old woman who was about to be fired from her job. Why don't you tell us a little bit about her, and then I'll read some of the patient-therapist exchanges that I think are very illustrative.
So something interesting about her is that the way she arrived was already quite over the top. She went to my building. I wasn't in, asked to speak with me without any previous consultation, without anything. She did send me an email, but I haven't answered because it was like less than 24 hours. And the secretary sent me an email saying this person was there, blah, blah, blah. And she left. But she was already treating me like an emergency service. Something really peculiar was happening. And then I started working with her. And immediately there was this sense of everybody's after me and I am so wounded, I am so vulnerable. Why? She actually kept saying this to me. Why this always keeps happening to me? Why it always keeps happening to me? And what she meant is people horrendously attacking her, discriminating her, abusing her. But it became evident that she was looking for that left, right, and center. For example, she was fighting. The reason why she was going to be fired is that she was not working. And then in a public setting, so her monitor, her computer was seen by everyone, she was doing other things that were clearly not work related. Like she would be turning on a video in YouTube, for example, instead of working like she should mm-hmm. be. So the manager will come and say, please, can you work? And she will cry, say, why is he singling me out? Why is he doing this to me? And my impression is that this manager was overworked and he quite likely didn't want the bother, he didn't want the trouble, that she was not going to get fired if she will just calm down. But of course, she wouldn't. And that is what was happening in all places, including quite early with me. She would start saying that she will have problems with the fee and try to change the setting. But at the same time that she will arrive with a really expensive purse and letting me know that it was new. So you have all these elements of provocations and challenges for minute one.
All right. So the patient says to you, you write, quote, I can't believe this is happening to me. Why doesn't the operational manager remove my manager instead of letting them keep doing this to me? You say, it sounds like you don't feel listened to or taken into account. Patient says, it's not that I feel that way. It is that I am not being supported or listened to. They don't care. Therapist says, hopefully we can create something here where you feel that I care and that what you're going through matters to me. Patient says, I hope so, although I'm not sure we can. Now, this is a very telling exchange where you are empathizing with her feelings, and she makes clear to you that in her mind, this is not about her feelings. This is about the fact that there isn't a space between how she feels and what she imagines or insists reality is like, which is not a good indication for an exploratory therapy, needless to say. So what was that like for you?
Yeah, there is, it's 100%. Is this a struggle with fairness or symbolization? Or when we are assessing students to join our courses, one of the things is really important for them to show is that when they're talking about clinical cases, they are able to understand that if they say the mother of the patient or the father or the whoever is an internal object, is not the real person. Even if there was real, genuine abuse, what the patient is bringing is a symbolic representation, is their own idea, right? And not the concrete, real mother. And here was as concrete as it will be. Like what you say is 100% right. It's no symbolism. So it's either you are on my side, realizing that this manager is horrible, the operational manager is horrible, or you're against me. Because there is no possibility for her to entertain the idea that I will see something different to her and that she has a flexibility for us to interact in a way that we can say there are two different points of view. How can you talk about it? How do they come together? Here is only hers or misunderstanding.
That is, I could see something different than you say and indicate to the patient, but I'm still on your side. That's the space that is impossible for them to recognize. Yeah, that's what you're saying.
Yes, that is my attempt to avoid the negative transference. That is kind of sensing from the get-go, it's likely that I'm going to flip at some point. It's likely that the way she looks at me in the transference is going to become negative. In the case of money, was already building up. I'm going to be the cruel psychoanalyst that has all the money in the world and is taking for her that she barely has enough money to buy something. So it's my attempt to say, look, I am here to help. Look, I am not this persecutory, challenging person. And is someone that is, like you said, on your side. So hopefully that can sit in.
though inevitably and predictably, this will enter the transference and will become heightened, as you describe in the book. As she constantly complains about others and assumes you agree with her, she then ups the ante, and she asks you to write a support letter for her employer, stating the emotional damage her manager had caused her. Instead of trying to interpret my way out of the situation or writing the letter and colluding, you say, I took a firm but compassionate approach. Quote, I'm sorry, I can't do this for you. I want to help, but I can't get involved outside our sessions. Interesting way to say it. Patient responds, that means you don't really care, doesn't it? It's all talk with you. You say, I see why you feel that way, and I hope we can continue working together so you can see this is not the case. Now, when I read that exchange, I had a clear picture in my mind of this is a treatment soon to end, because of all the obvious reasons that you will try to both not provide exactly what she wants, and yet at the same time be on her side in more ways than she even understands, because you're on the side of her that has the potential to grow as opposed to be binary, but that she's not going to understand it and the treatment will be interrupted and failed. But in fact, something else happens, which for me, this brief exchange at the very beginning of the book really captures the essence of the book. You say that this therapy lasted 14 months. You write, supporting her through the loss of her job and her transition to a new one. At the end of our work, I recommended dynamic therapy with a colleague, but I never heard back from her. Despite this, I believe I provided a positive therapeutic experience during a critical period in her life. This is the key takeaway, you say. A patient who would likely be diagnosed with borderline personality had a constructive and containing therapeutic experience during one of the hardest times in her life. So for me, what you're doing is saying, and you'll let me know if I'm accurate in this, you're saying we as a field have to have multiple models of success. We need to feel we are constructive in our lives and in our work. And we often assure ourselves of that with profound, meaningful psychoanalytic changes over long periods of time with few numbers of patients whose lives are fundamentally healed. But then there is this category of engagement where the supportive work doesn't do that, provides something else, provides a transitory support for someone going through a crisis that's well beyond her capacities to manage. And by being present with her in supportive ways, you help her manage it without fundamentally changing her borderline organization. Now, that's how I interpret it. Tell me how close I got.
No, 100%. And it's a really nice way of putting it. Multiple levels of success, actually. Wrote that down. Usually, I refer it as expectations. I think that when we get ourselves into trouble, it's if we don't have the right expectation. If you jump in, because I like what you said, I hear this session and suddenly feel this is going to come to an end. So from that perspective, the fact that we last during the crisis made it an amazing work. But we can default into believing that we are there to cure, that we are there to something that is unrealistic, or to feel that if you are not there with that aim of making the patient, like you said, have a deep change, you have given up. And it isn't. It's like you have mentioned before, meeting the patient at this level and having the right expectations. And yet this patient, when she started having the meetings with HR, and then it became evident that she has triggered the classic professionalism of HR. They are friendly on your side, but not really. They're kind of getting rid of you because of all the things you have done. I felt that a healthy part of her was suddenly saying, oh, this is real. What have I done? That she never communicated. But what she communicated is, oh, I need to start preparing financially. What is going to happen with my husband? Like, I need to start getting ready for what I'm doing. So there was a part of her that was really suffering through this chaos. And having me there to just each week be there listening and suddenly thinking about it with her, in not trying to solve it, but being with her, with, she was sometimes saying, for example, in one session, she was starting to say how she needed to now start buying rice in a bulk so she can save money and all of that. And in many ways, you allowed her to bring that chaos, to bring that both things, the provocation of my son is going to be hungry and you are taking my money away as my analyst, but at the same time, I just buy a new purse or I am going on holidays. These two contradictory, but trying to engage with the real anxiety element of it. I think that was quite a meaningful thing. I think trying to interpret any of it is tempting, but I don't think I had a patient with the resources to do it.
I think you're identifying that she was able to sit with the anxiety, which is a developmental step well beyond her paranoid accusations, is a major accomplishment. And I assume that she could only have done that with your condition. Like you say, I was being with her, and the with herness enabled her to say, I'm really in a tough spot here and I have to deal with this tough spot. And maybe for the psychodynamic therapy that she did or didn't get into, that will give her a situation where she could consider what leads her to provoke this in her life and from others, as she will undoubtedly act it out with the next therapist. One of the ways you describe these patients is that they're phobic about intimacy. You write, for many patients, the interdependence of therapy is deeply anxiety provoking. Their past experiences have taught them that dependency is a source of pain, abandonment, or abuse, making them wary of trusting another. This highlights a central paradox of the facilitating environment. While it is theoretically a space that fosters emotional growth and security, in practice, many patients experience it with ambivalence, reacting almost phobically to the intimacy and emotional vulnerability it entails. You want to say more about that?
Yes, I think the challenge is that one element that psychoanalysis is quite good is that you bring the relationship to the center. So there is an issue of dependency, there is an issue with all of these type of things, a break will come along and then they will experience it and so on. But that is the same thing that is giving anxiety to the patient. So for example, a case that I didn't see myself, but my supervisee did, was of a woman who, when she was 11, her mother took her to the equivalent of a crack house, where she exchanged her for heroin. And out of mercy, they get her high on heroin before being sexually abused. And then social services step in really fast, and then she was in a foster family. Anyway, she's in their mid-20s, and my supervisee started working with her. And my supervisee said something within the lines of, I am here for you, or trust me, something within those lines. And the patient answered, if my mother, who was to be the main person in my life to protect me and to love me, did this to me, what makes you think that I will trust you? And I think that is a beautiful representation of two things. One, the reality of the challenge. Like, I literally don't feel that in life I can trust people. If you want to start something that rely on trust or something like that, we're going to fail. But also, how challenging is for her to relate? What type of monsters will you encounter if you were able to work in the transference? What type of projections of paranoia will come? Like, it sounds really, really difficult. And of course, in this element, you try to maneuver around it. It's not a... I'm not trying to sell an easy fix, because it's actually really, really challenging. And you're constantly trying to avoid the patient disappearing, not showing up. But this component is saying, look, the relationship in itself will be a source of anxiety. Paradoxically enough, if you're a good therapist, that you're offering support and you're there available for the patient, that might actually make them feel more anxious, because they might trigger with a level of dependency they don't feel comfortable. So it's really paradoxical that something that might make another person feel comfortable and in a safe place here might even come and become something negative. So it's an invitation to be quite proactive in those elements. Mm.
You know, I've heard you tell that story once before about the mother who gave her daughter up in order to get heroin. And you talk reasonably enough about the challenge to work with that daughter. And I think it needs to be said that psychoanalysis as a field, by and large, with notable exceptions, you being one of them, don't take that challenge up. We don't work with patients like that. In part, they don't make their way to our offices, sure, but we don't have interest, not to mention theory, to help us understand and engage with that challenge of people who are abused to that degree. Now, I know that many analysts do treat patients who have been that traumatized. But as a field, your book is important because it does say, what do we do with these people? How do we understand what happens? And since we know the relationship is so central to this work and to the patient feeling differently about themselves and their lives, what happens when that kind of, hatred, disregard, desperateness of a mother to a child, what happens when that enters the relationship? How do you manage it for their best interest? So I just want to put that out there, that's in this, and why this work of yours in this book does engage that challenge. To get more abstract for the moment, you also talk about thirdness, and you write, Britain also explored how some individuals find the concept of thirdness intolerable. He described patients who could not accept differing viewpoints, experiencing them as threats rather than alternative perspectives. In therapy, these patients react defensively, even aggressively, when the analyst expresses an independent thought, revealing the deep-rooted fear of being excluded from an emotional link. And the last point you say is crucial in managing patients in supportive therapy, as they only can tolerate often therapeutic relationships that operate entirely on their own terms. One of the ways I see this is when people, sometimes in the field, will say, well, I wish you had said what you said in this way, and will then say what they think is the better way to say it, which is often the case, but doesn't address the issue of what it was like to receive the very imperfect way that I said it. Anything more you want to say about the thirdness?
But it can even be more concrete than that. What comes to mind is I remember a patient who felt the housing officer was horrible. So the context will be that although they are in a unit, they still need to pay towards them staying there. The reason for it was quite political. The government decided that people who were also unemployed needed to contribute. So it's a funny thing, but the point being is that they needed to contribute something towards them being in a unit, even though that something they contribute is paid by the government, but directly to them, and then they go and pay it. It's called a service charge.
Okay.
So that is part of the dynamic that they put in. And this patient hadn't paid a service charge for God knows how long. And the service charge was the equivalent of £17 a week. And the housing officer was ready to start sending eviction letters and all these type of things. And she came to see me with such a rage. And she was wrong about what was going to happen. She was wrong about the concrete reality of the process and the evilness of the housing officer. Everything was... And actually, if she would knew the truth, I would assume that she would be more relieved. No one was after her. No one wanted to put her in the streets. Data will work against us. If someone gets evicted, it's worse for us. It's not better. So all of that... But you could not do that. You could not simply say, actually, no one wants to get you out of here so they can have a bed for someone else. If we get you out of here in this way, we get in trouble. It's worse for us, right? No, it was kind of like either you listen to me in rage and you accept this housing officer is a monster, this institution is a paranoid, horrendous monster that they just persuade homeless people to come along just to later shout them in the street for some financial reason that isn't clear. If you don't take this, then you are with them. So it's quite challenging. It's quite challenging. Yeah.
Even more so when you are that horrendous monster and they are committed to seeing you that way. That sort of deepens the challenge. Let me read an example you give, a less, in some ways, less dramatic example. You write, this is an example of what you call resistance and supportive therapy, and it's the case of an 18-year-old, you say, who came to see me as his parents believed he needed therapy. After experiencing a small emotional breakdown, his mother had cancer a few years ago, and she had a relapse just a few years before his emotional breakdown. The patient didn't want to speak about his mother's cancer at all. He barely mentioned it during the assessment, and the sessions became focused on girls and friends. It was clear that his fear of losing his mother was present and causing problems, but it is not the role of supportive therapy to address it directly. This doesn't mean that there was no psychodynamic thinking around it that could benefit from other interventions. For example, I understood why his friend was such a safe haven in relation to what was happening at home. I also understood that he was fearful of getting close to girls when they could also become ill. This allowed me to have an emotional connection with the patient where I could follow the mood and verbal content of the session. You want to say more about that?
I really like the case because, like you said, he's not that unwell, and this patient told me a lot. The context was that I just finished my second training as a psychodynamic psychotherapist, and I felt I needed to prove a lot. And I clearly arrived with the wrong agenda, that it was that if I was a good enough and a smart enough, a clever enough, just graduated as a psychodynamic psychotherapist, I would manage to get into why the patient is struggling so much with the realization of the cancer of the mother, that is a resistant. He didn't want to touch the topic at all. And why is making him feel the way that it is, right? So basically, if I uncover the underlying reason why the cancer of his mother was so extremely distressing and be able to explore with him how he's processing this, I will be helping him. And I was extremely wrong. And I did a lot of interventions in between that the patient was really generous, really, really generous with me. And how the case, generous, what I meant is he was forgiven. He clearly was tolerating me trying to push for something he really had no appetite for. Like, for example, at some point I interpret his mother being his mother was unwell and then he became unwell. And I was trying to push towards him to see a level of identification between his illness with the illness of the mother and type of things like that, that in my mind, I remember the textbooks will say, if he realized that he has an unconscious feelings of guilt towards his mother, he will feel better. But then I didn't. And the case ended where 1 week before his mother's surgery, he came to see me and out of the blue, he said, the surgery is next week. And that even the way he said it was really meaningful, because even though we were not talking at all about the cancer of her mother, I had a few attempts, but clearly didn't work and he was not there. And I was just, again, talking about friends, school, music, all of those type of things. He brought it well aware that I knew about it. He brought it saying, the surgery is next week. So it felt like a topic that although we have not talked about, it was shared to one degree. And basically the mother had gone through chemotherapy and radiotherapy. The tumor was small enough. Went to surgery. They removed it. And then he came the next week, explained that everything went well. And then he left. And I felt for many years that I didn't do a good job. And it was decades, little more than a decade later, that looking back, going back to what you said about expectation, well, what we were saying about expectations and the different types of what we're meant to be doing, I realized how meaningful I was for this person in a different way than what I wanted to do. But it was really important for him to have someone being aware of what he was going through, listening, caring, even though if I was not interpreting or touching the topic at all.
You also give an example, very understandable for all of us who have been trainees and those of us who work with trainees, how understandable it is that they want to do what they think is the right thing. And focusing on where a particular patient is not often deemed the right thing if it's outside the theory that their program may value. that's a topic for another time, perhaps. You write, there's another group of patients, you say, there's that are well-suited for supportive therapy. They're called thin-skinned narcissistic patients. And you say, these patients tend to be highly vulnerable, hypervigilant, and easily humiliated, often leaving therapists feeling as though they are walking on eggshells. Such patients struggle to tolerate the intensity of dynamic psychotherapy, particularly when they misinterpret interpretations as personal criticisms rather than invitations to think. A gentler therapeutic approach can help prevent such dropouts. Now, you know, as I'm reading these selections from the book, there are a number of themes that are obviously emerging, and that is, one of them is that when the patient perceives the therapist's effort to help them as in some way other than that and in some way malevolent, and what does one do with that? And it raises the question about, is that indicating that the lesion is, the emotional lesion, is that they can't receive the goodness? I mean, the therapist, whatever their theoretical orientation or commitment, is hopefully fundamentally there to be of use to the patient. And we're describing patients who have trouble receiving that, trouble even understanding that. And yes, for traumatic examples like you described of the drug-addicted mother, but how does one do in the face of that? What does one do in the face of that when it's basically a paranoid orientation, and pointing out something that the patient may not be aware of isn't experienced or understood as trying to open their mind and their lives and their world a bit, but instead, why are you telling me I'm such a failure? What do you think?
Yeah, I think even in classic psychoanalytic technique, Kohut or Rosenfeld will definitely suggest to work differently. They will immediately suggest to avoid the negative transference because it's hard with this kind of presentation. The problem that I find is that if you have this challenging presentation and at the same time they're going through something horrible in life, it's once again, what do you do with that? So, for example, I remember a case of a man who started using heroin and things went bad really soon. He injected in his leg and got septicemia, an infection, gangrene. I really don't know the in and out. I just know there was an amputee. And then he came to our service and then he was with me. And it was extremely hard to work with him. I remember he came to my office without an appointment and he opened the door and said to me, I have done all the things that you have done, you know? And I reacted quite defensive, something about, oh, so you have done the budgets of whatever, I don't know why. And then I pulled myself back of it. But then I immediately realized that this was not going to work if I take that stand. And when we have the first time that we met officially, there was going to be rivalry, there was going to be insults. He was a successful man that suddenly life went really wrong. He didn't like living where he was. He felt humiliated just by in his eyes, I was a person of success. So he felt denigrated by me and he needed to be above me. But when I worked with him, my aim was not to tackle the narcissism. My name, like you said, I don't have a goal of those kinds. My aim is this man suddenly found himself in the streets, is homeless, his whole life is upside down. There is a complicated level of support he needs outside therapy, outside this element, about housing, about putting his life together. He needs someone to survive with him while this is happening. So the sessions were all about talking about football, talking about healthy things, healthy by not being either mine or his, kind of being the talking about other things that will be tolerable. But at the same time, you're progressively getting to know each other. And at the same time, he has someone for the first time in his life, well, for the first time since his life went really bad, that is there consistently. And that, again, that is the right expectation. That is what you mentioned, multiple levels of success. In my mind, is if I survive with him being mortally wounded by me suggesting that he's not better than me, for example, right? If I survive all this treatment, until he's able to move into independent living. And yeah. he had me for all this time. That was amazing. That is amazing. So that is kind of the level of success, if you see.
Sure. Yeah. Another important point in the therapy you're proposing is that it isn't short term. You say many patients feel relieved knowing they will have a consistent open space rather than a short term intervention focused only on symptoms. Now, that's true for open-ended psychoanalysis. That may be one of the supportive elements that isn't as well recognized, that just being present, and the way you say it beautifully, is needing someone to survive with. I mean, that's true in all of our lives, but this is not a short-term therapy. Can you say something about how you came to appreciate how vital that is?
So one good case is a young man who had a baby. Things went really bad during the delivery, and he developed a full-on anxiety, what will be diagnosed with an anxiety disorder after the incident. But he tried kind of PTSD intervention. It was clearly that it was not trauma. He tried CBT, and he found it ridiculous. He didn't want to be talking about techniques. But he was quite unsettled, and he was struggling to go back to work and so on. And I was with him while he became a new father. When all of this was happening, we established a good relationship. We were working really well. He went back to the things that he liked to do before and couldn't. Like he lost the symbolic capacity for creativity. He was quite unwell. He progressively recovered. But it becomes really interesting, the idea of ending in this case, because we didn't have an ending. And that was quite a sense of relief. And he brought it back repeatedly. And I didn't understand why, but he's like, this is for you. And when you feel that we don't need it anymore, we can have that conversation. Is that how you feel now? No, I need this. Fine. And then suddenly he disclosed that his wife was, well, they were trying to get pregnant again. He didn't tell me. And then they succeed. So then for him was really meaningful that I stayed together until they give birth again. And you can see why. He was terrified of this happening again. But the point being is that him, since he was trying, him knowing that we don't have an end date, him knowing that if I am needed, is going to be there, was really, really meaningful and part of the support. If you had an expiration date, that in itself could be a source of distress. That in itself can be tricky. That doesn't mean that you work forever. Of course not. But you don't have the expiration date as a pending threat upon the treatment.
That's an important to note. Fundamentally, you say, the therapist's mindset is crucial, regardless of the intervention or the handling of negative transference. You write, I have often seen students and supervisees make mistakes when supportive therapy is required and their mindset is one of exploration. If a therapist approaches treatment with the belief that success depends upon discovery, uncovering unconscious material, or expanding awareness, they inevitably steer the treatment narrative in that direction. In moments of emotional pain, the therapist might fail to offer empathy, instead opting for curiosity, which is not well received by this particular type of patient. You write, in supportive therapy, patients require assistance in strengthening or rebuilding their defenses, not in dismantling them. Now, I have a question about this. You're making a binary distinction between empathy and curiosity. And it seems to me that they most always can go together, with obvious exceptions. But even in an analysis, an analysis is not the setting for the absence of empathy. It's just usually titrated with curiosity. But tell me what you think.
Yes, I think that you cannot have curiosity with a level of empathy, isn't it? So I think that what I meant is that they want to understand the patient and instead of being there for the patient. So the mindset becomes problematic really fast. I have a case that, because I'm addressing their students, and probably the case that I was holding in mind was a brilliant student who was really agile with Melanie Klein. And she was working in a unit for mood disorders. And suddenly there was this young patient who I think went through a breakup, can't remember very well, and basically ended diagnosed with bipolar disorder and was sectioned. And she started working with her in the ward. And she had the wrong frame of mind because she loved Melanie Klein. She loved the idea of manic depressive. And she had this idea or this irrational expectation that she will stop episodes if she managed or helped the patient get depressed. That I think was an unreasonable expectation. The patient then relapsed and it was all that happening. But while you were seeing all of that, you were able to tell that they have built a really good relationship, that the patient really cared for their sessions, and that the patient really felt listened and cared for. The problem is, on the other side, you have a therapist that has a cure mentality, that has an exploration mentality, that almost felt responsible for the relapse, even though they were psychiatrists. They know very well that in mood disorders, relapse will happen and they're not a reflection of your work. So instead of offering someone that can be there with you while you suddenly get this diagnosis, while your whole life goes upside down because now you're a young person with a mood disorder, you don't know what that means, you have someone trying to fix you. And that fell out of tune. That felt like they were trying to do two different things.
Again, it was serving the needs of the therapist to feel like a curer as opposed to attending to the patient, including in this case, the biology of the patient. Let me ask you to go ahead. Sorry, you're going to say something?
And in my fantasy, if the student needs help by being told what is driving you is an unconscious anxiety to be a good student, fair enough. You can also be a good student if you offer support therapy. Being a good student is to know this distinction. In this case, I don't think the student knew there was another option. And that was part of the issue. Being good was being psychodynamically as interpreting, exploring.
Is that a limitation of her trainers, her mentors, her teachers? That they didn't lay out that, as we were talking earlier, that is an important, reasonable, and often life-saving goal for particular patients?
The feeling is more that if you are able to provide an understanding through listening in a way that the patient can find a level of truth, sort of speak, that is how you feel better. So if you wanted your patient to feel better when they're having a whole this episode or all of that, if you help them understand the reason behind that, the patient will have a relief. So the invitation, although might not be that concrete, you can help them understand just by attentive listening or a listening like Ogden will propose. But nonetheless, it's an invitation to do a level of transformation upon the unconscious, if that makes sense, yeah. Instead of just bearing the reality and being with them.
You have a whole section on, you write, the problem of collusion, which is very important. Want to elaborate that for our listeners?
I think that if we are saying the patient is completely binary in some occasions and they will not tolerate a different opinion, then it becomes really difficult, right? Because you have, for example, the patient that I referred to was crashing with a housing officer. Agreeing with their position is also not the answer because you cannot turn around and say, oh, he's so horrible for you that these people keep abusing you. And how about for you that now you are living in a place that are a bunch of greedy, horrible people that are against you? How bad is that, right? Or when a patient clearly break up in a relationship where there is a lot of their fault. I remember a patient who was unfaithful to their partner and was extremely angry that him will not forgive her because he was not forgiven. So suddenly she reverted the problem between I just betrayed him to he's not forgiven. So she's again the victim. So in all of these moments, it's really easy to then turn around and take their side. But it's the wrong thing because you will collude with the pathology. You will collude with the parts that they are not willing to do. And if they have a healthy part of themselves, they will actually run away because they don't want to be their own distortion of reality is the cause of pain. So you need to stay within something different. You need to stay with not challenging the patient. You can definitely validate the distress. You can validate the struggle without validating the reality and colluding then with this version of life that usually victimizes them and so on.
Though, you know, we often speak of the art of psychoanalysis. What you just described really captures the art of supportive psychotherapy. How does one encounter the invitation, if not insistence, to engage in a binary way? And how do you, when faced with that, try to find a third way that will satisfy the patient? Let me take a moment to raise a question about all this work. Clearly, there are patients, and you've described many of them, for whom a purely, in quotes, purely supportive approach is the obvious choice. However, when it is not that kind of patient, when it's not that kind of patient, I don't know how else to describe it, when we first meet them, we start from a mindset of being curious about them, curious about how their mind works, among other things. And we begin to notice the patterns of associations and responses to our presence and our interventions. And over time, as we listen, we learn generally that all patients have some capacity for metaphoric considerations. And I don't mean intellectualized ones. I mean affectively immediate metaphoric considerations. And also all patients at times reveal some areas where they're inclined to action or somatization or just a literal orientation, that we're all a mix of that. And I see our work as sort of bending to and fro with our own complementary, symbolizing, and concrete mutualities. In other words, instead of thinking that this is supportive therapy or this is psychoanalytic therapy, for me, that bending to and fro is just treating a patient without the categories. What's your thought about that?
Yes, it's really important that difficulty of what is the purpose and why do we need to divide what we do and or categorize what we do. And in the book, I think it's in page 7 or 8, I put a kind of boxes all type of therapies that I, for a starting point, don't believe in, don't believe that it's such as boxes like that. And my editor had a problem with that. I had a problem. It is such an impossibility. But for two reasons, after a diagnosis and also for teaching, we do need to have clear distinctions. And I don't always buy this idea of we're all doing the same thing. I know that is not what you're saying. You're saying something different. But in many ways, it's important to then say, look, in these extremes, treatment is different. Treatment is possible in this way. I agree with you that, for example, many British independent will be doing something quite similar where they have moved completely away from interpreting and they focus more on the relationship and the survival of the relationship in upon aggression. And there is a lot of similarity or crossovers. But there is an important element almost in my mind when we are making a treatment recommendation to hold this in mind. So for example, if you have someone that is in this threshold, that will they be able to use it or not, and they are in a crisis in their life, and they can come to you only once a week, but you want to apply something that will be more beneficial 3 times a week, intense treatment, and the patient is in a really difficult time, I would argue in those moments, having these superficial distinctions can be useful, can create from the beginning a mindset that will hopefully provide the patient with a level of support in a moment of crisis without attempting to do something that, you have very little chances of succeeding.
That's well said and very helpful. Thank you. Rodrigo, let me ask you, it is, as I said, and as we all know, this is your path of appreciating and studying supportive therapy, especially as it applies with at times very desperate individuals, is not the usual path for psychoanalysts. Can you share with us, whatever you're comfortable sharing, about who you are and how you got here? Well, like, what are you doing here kind of thing?
Yeah, so I arrived to United Kingdom not thinking that I was going to work with homelessness. And I was doing my psychoanalytic formation. And it was really tricky because I had two trainings already, clinical psychology and psychodynamic psychotherapy. So I thought that when I was joining homelessness, it was going to be appreciated. And there is an ongoing attack on thinking in these systems that is really complicated. People don't appreciate thinking. Well, heroin is the antithesis of thinking in many ways, but also happen in the structure of the systems, in the communication with the local authority, in managing teams. So suddenly I went from an experience of thinking, well, psychoanalysis feels like irrelevant, to realizing that psychoanalysis was the reason why I was surviving, comparing myself with other colleagues that they were struggling quite a lot. Quite clearly, I remember a case where one of our patients committed suicide, and that always moves all of us. It's really hard. And one of the people I was managing was reacting really dismissive, but they were really close. So out of intuition, I guess, I started talking with her. And he said, but why is it that you're almost cold about all of this? And she said, because I don't care. Once that someone kills themselves, that means they don't care. I said, okay, that was funny. And then she continued saying, my mother did that to me when I was 16. My mother committed suicide. And that means that if they don't care to live, you shouldn't care for them. You're like, this sounds so heavy, so difficult, so charged. And your attitude is, there is nothing to think about. And I was actually, that case, I tried to get more help and more funding for her to go to personal therapy. There was a contradiction because she didn't feel she needed. That kind of position for me, the journey of how meaningful psychoanalysis can be, but in a different way. Psychoanalysis is not only about clever interpretations. Psychoanalysis can be a lot about the tools to help us feel what we are experiencing. And in those radical settings, I have multiple examples of many times that you become almost the object you are projected, and you need a frame of mind to kind of ground you into you are not that and offer something different. So that is why I thought it was really useful.
That's very powerful. And that's a take-home message for all of us, how a psychoanalytic mindset can be useful behind the couch and, as you say, off the couch, in the community, working with homeless and working with heroin addicts, etc. So I want to thank you for your work, and I'm holding your book as I say that. Again, the name is Contemporary Developments in Supportive Therapy, Principles and Practice. Rodrigo, it's been a pleasure. It's been a pleasure for me to learn and to meet you. So thank you for both.
No, thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.